So today,
try those if you want them.
Beth got home from, she went to coffee. Oh,
there
we are. So, and anyway, I was talking about something. I turned off, like, I don't know if you like look at shorts, if you like watch shorts ever, like Instagram and stuff like that.
Oh,
yeah.
Reels.
Reels. Sorry. They're on YouTube. They're shorts.
Oh, I don't have YouTube.
So my favorite thing on the planet, Beth's like, what are you watching? And I'm like, I'm watching some stuff on Egyptology. And she's like, why? I'm really interested. It's important to me. So why is it important to you? It's like, I said, Beth, there's no way. There's no way these men built these pyramids. Like, it's not possible. And so this YouTube channel guy who's an archaeologist, he's showing...
Aliens?
Huh, no. Of course not. Aliens are just demons.
That's what I'm asking.
And so anyway, he's laying out the tools and like how could they do this with primitive tools. And primitive tools like even some forms of iron, which would have pushed them past their own dating. And he's like, no, like you can't do it. And there's perfect holes that actually have like indentions from a tool on it, but they're perfect circles and they're perfectly straight tubing. It's like, this doesn't happen. Like you can't do this with what's it called? The thing you sculpt with.
Chisel?
A chisel. You can't do the chisel. Mm-hmm. Like it's perfectly graded. They're perfectly patterned. It's an impossibility.
And a core drill.
It is. That's exactly what it is. And I'm like, there's no way. But they're like this big around.
So are we living in the Matrix?
No, we're not. Nephilim did it.
The Nephilim had core drills?
They had something of that technology. So here's where I am. There's a whole...
It wasn't demons. It was Nephilim.
They invented DeWalt.
Yeah, that's the brand. DeWalt to demons. But anyway, my whole idea of this is I think there were two great cities before the flood. The two great cities before the flood were Atlantis and a city in Egypt. And so the Egyptians that we study, the Egyptians of the Exodus, they didn't build those pyramids. They were there.
No, the flood would have destroyed them.
No, the flood would not have destroyed those pyramids. No.
A flood over all of the mountains in the world?
No, I don't think it would have destroyed them. I think that's the point.
I hear you. I think you're wrong, but that's cool.
I don't think the flood would have destroyed them. There are plenty of things that survived the flood. Not living things, but that's the point.
Yeah, I hear you, but like, no.
Okay, whatever.
Aren't there dead, like...
The water was flying out of the ground.
Yeah, but that's around the fault lines.
Sure.
I think that's around the fault lines, and certainly so like you're talking about the fountains of the great deep burst forth. That's where the fault lines were, and so that's why you would have had such destruction. But I think they survived, and like we say all the time that the Egyptians buried their dead inside of those pyramids. There's mm-hmm. there's not a single person buried there.
So where's the
I thought they just buried the kings.
No.
What about Atlantis then?
Atlantis is in the Sahara Desert. We know this.
Okay.
Man's drunk.
I mean, like, but that's the whole thing. Like, I'm really convinced that there are two great cities. And I think that what you have, what?
Nothing. What about Nimrod? That was after the flood.
That was after the flood.
Yeah, no. So was he a Nephilim?
That's a great question. I don't think he was. But I do think that he was like Pharaoh-ish, like influenced by the demonic. He was, yeah. He was certainly an antagonist. He was not a, like the phrase Nimrod was a great hunter before the Lord. Mm-hmm. That's an indictment. That's not a compliment to him.
Hmm. Welcome to Products of Conspiracies, a podcast by Mercy Hill Church.
I don't think that's conspiracies.
My name is Conspiracy Steve.
Can you hear Blake?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's just a little bit low.
I do feel a little low.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it up a little bit.
None of that has to make it. True story.
I just keep seeing that meme of the dude with the crazy hair who says aliens when you say this stuff.
Oh, well, it's not aliens. Yeah, I've just become really convinced that there's no way humans built the pyramids. Or that an incredibly advanced civilization before the flood built them. I'll accept that as an option as well.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think they survived. I think they survived the global flood. I am convinced of that at this point. All right, I'm going to do the intro.
Hang on, we got to Which one are we talking about?
I don't know. I thought you're... I'm not in charge of this. Welcome to Products of Grace, a podcast by Mercy Hill Church. My name is Lawson Harlow, and with me today I have Blake McCullough and Dr. Anik.
All right.
Sitting in for Don, who is on a date with his best friend.
And sister.
And sister. Not like Abraham's kind of sister, but anyway, it's Valentine's Day. We don't observe the calendar because we're Christians. And
I'm just here because I have to be.
I'm just here so I won't get fined. I'm just here so I won't get fined. And Blake's here because he won't get fined.
I would celebrate.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I would celebrate Halloween.
Oh, let's do this. What would you do today? Like if you were to plan a date for Valentine's Day, what would you do?
You would give your
children to someone in your family first.
Indeed.
Because you're not doing a babysitter again.
Nope.
He was acquainted with babysitters for the first time.
I hired a babysitter for the first time.
Like a rando babysitter?
I have never paid a babysitter in 4.5 years of having children.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild. Like, I understand.
Have you paid a babysitter before?
Yeah, but they've been like girls from church.
Yeah, right, right.
So this,
yeah.
That's what we did. Yeah.
Okay.
And she did great. Shout out if for any of your babysitter needs, shout out Carissa King. Mm-hmm. But I was like, it was the first time that I'd ever like paid money for someone to watch my kids. And it was just a weird experience. And I was like,
he didn't know how much a babysitter cost is what happened.
I had to ask Lawson how much it cost. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. And so, yeah, I'm just going to wait and go on a date whenever my parents are free.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do that. I'd drop the kids off with my parents. I'd go, we have like 4 gift cards that we either got from pastor appreciation or Christmas or teacher appreciation that we haven't used. So I'd go to one of those places. And then maybe, you know, I like to walk around. Like I want to go.
You're going to Target?
I don't go to a movie.
We always go to Target. Always, 100%. Day. We usually buy like a scrub brush or something.
I like going to like antique stores.
We have a Sheffield's date planned sometime soon.
Shout out to Sheffield's.
We're excited.
Mm-hmm.
This is crazy. Summer Avenue, little like secret antique store tour, basically.
Okay.
You can start like on at Sycamore View. I think it's called A Place in Time or something.
Okay.
And then like there's literally like 7 antique stores. If you just go from there to like Broad Avenue area, you can just hit them all. We did that over Christmas break. It was great.
Do your jeans get skinnier as you go from antique store to antique store?
As you get closer to Broad.
My jeans are so skinny.
Okay.
They can't get any skinnier.
That's weird.
Fair. I don't even know what that means.
sounds like a good date.
What would you do?
Yeah, what would you do?
So I'm actually going on a date tomorrow.
What are you
going
to do?
We're hiring a babysitter. I'm not telling you who it is because I don't want people to start using her. Because I'm stingy.
What are you going to do? You don't go on a date every night.
I just want to make sure that she's available. So,
he's got her on retainer.
Sorry about your financial future, whoever you are.
So anyway, we're going to go to a gift card. We have a gift card to Parrish, which we're very excited
for. Amen to that. That's one of the ones we have.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to using it. I've had it for far too long.
Indeed.
Our babysitter is going to come at like 4:30 because something that is important to know about my family in general. We're not leaving the house after 6. Like we're willing to leave the house before 6. Like I'll come, but after 6, it's like, let's just not. Let's do 5 or 4:30 or something like that. I know that I live in a trivial world that nobody else can do these things. But
it's a privilege.
Yeah, it is a privilege. But so like privilege. Anyway, so we're gonna go do that. And then Beth has a couple of places that she's wanted to go shopping, and we're gonna go do that and not buy anything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
is that how shopping works?
It's how shopping works right now.
Looking works.
Yeah, it's how shopping works right now in my house, which is where we look at it and we're like, oh, that'd be great. Next place. Like, we're not buying this. So
sounds lame.
That would be ours. And then we're probably going to get ice cream because we don't come home without ice cream.
You go to Area 51?
If we're still in Hernando, then yes. If we're not in Hernando, I make an appeal for TCBY.
Huh.
I love TCBY. Get that look off your face. Anyway.
Is that your look of TCBY or of sour spaghetti?
It's TCBY.
TCBY is great. Charles?
So we don't usually do the Valentine's thing because we have Christmas and then we have Beth's birthday on January 2nd and then our anniversary on January 6th and then Levi's birthday Cedar's birthday. And so we're all kind of like celebrated out by
and
then.
Broke.
And
on the mic, you can't?
Can't hear them too?
At all?
I mean, I can edit it in post probably, but if you can't hear them like hardly at all, I'll go look at it.
Okay.
We'll pause it. Thank you.
Pause. Glad you caught that now and not an hour from now. Trip, my guy. Oh, you just wanted to be on the podcast.
No.
That's what happened. You just wanted to be on the podcast.
I'm on Charles's mic, if that helps you, Charles.
You're hearing the late, great Drew Thomas, who was at one time a featured guest upon the Products of Grace podcast.
Late, great. I ain't dead yet.
Does that mean you're dead?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know that.
Don't count me out.
I didn't know that that's what that meant. My bad. He's still alive, fam.
Praise the Lord. He is alive.
Yeah. Back to your story.
So ask me about my Valentine's and we'll just cut it.
What would you do?
So Charles, what would you do on Valentine's Day?
All right. What a random question. let's see. So I just had this dream last night that we were driving down Walnut Grove, and somebody said the sunset is going to look really good tonight. And I thought I should call Coastal Fish Company and see if they randomly have some like reservations available for Valentine's, because I know they won't. But that would be really cool because me and Beth went for our anniversary like last year or something, and it had like the world's awesomest sunset that we've ever seen. We've made outside. Cool. And so, I don't know, that's been randomly
in
on January, my mind.
In January, you ate outside?
Yeah, we had like four heaters around us.
Oh, cool.
And it was pretty bad. It's like plastic too, right?
Yeah, but they stuck us outside the plastic.
Oh, ouch.
And it was a mite chilly, but the sunset was amazing.
Sweet, yeah, good to know. I've never been there.
It was super cool. Yep.
Think it's overrated.
You think everything's overrated.
That's not true. That's not true.
Okay.
Sarah loves it. I just think it's overrated.
Yep. Yeah.
So what are we doing today?
So today, what are we doing today? Yeah. Today we will discuss, I haven't made up a title for this episode, but we are going to discuss Exodus and maybe some thoughts about the love of God. Lawson thinks we can do all of it, but I don't know.
We shall see.
So we'll see. We'll start with the Exodus stuff. But because it's Valentine's, I said, let's find out today in this episode if love is blind, because that's just what
I hope we get to
with.
The love part.
Yep. But if not, I mean, in Exodus, there is a redemptive distinction that is often shown, showing God's love.
Is that inside
towards,
your vocabulary now?
Israel.
I made that phrase up,
I know,
and I feel really good about
it.
It's
great. It's great. I love
that's
it.
Like strange in between.
Mm-hmm.
I like both of those.
Yep, it's really good. Okay, I don't have, do y'all have any like stories or anything that you need to tell? I didn't have any great stories this week that I came up with to fill in like Don does, so.
I'm a trash storyteller. I was telling, I remember who I was talking to, we were talking about preaching, and I said there are two types of people. There are people that can preach parables and people who can't preach parables, so it must have been somewhere inside of and the storytellers, like the people who can just tell engaging stories, mm-hmm. can preach the parables really effectively.
Mm-hmm.
If you hand me a parable, I'm like, this is what it says. This is what it means. Next. And I just can't, like, I have such difficulty walking through the story anyway. So all that to say, Don's a really good storyteller, and I'm a trash storyteller, yeah, so I have no stories to tell.
Yes, Don is a really good storyteller. We were cracking up. Beth was listening to the most recent sermon from Sunday before small group.
Oh, no.
And you said something like, that donkey, as he was making his way, just knew that the lamb was more important than he was. And Beth goes,
It was intended to be narrative.
I was going
to
text Don in that moment.
Holy moly, bro. You said before, like later on, you were like, put yourself in place of the donkey. But at this point, you hadn't said that yet. And you were like, that donkey just knew. And Beth goes, that donkey didn't know nothing.
I like pulled out my phone. I didn't text him. I was about to text him and be like, that's a smart donkey.
Y'all are the worst.
It was Balaam's donkey.
Get that donkey a master's degree.
Holy moly.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So we got a lot of fun questions from Exodus. I was going to put these in order, so I'll try to kind of order them. Lawson came in as I was thinking about starting to put these in order, and we got into lots of good conversations before podcast, so that didn't happen. So
preparatory for Exodus.
They were great. Okay, so a question that I have that other people may have is, how do we know that Moses wrote Exodus? Because a lot of, like, Moses wrote the Pentateuch, and I know, like, historically, that's
the traditional
view. The traditional view is that Moses wrote it. But like in the Pauline letters, you know, the epistles, all that, it's like it says Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ. Like it says who wrote it, right? So what is the kind of historical case for Moses writing the
While I appreciate the historical case, I'm gonna go with the fact that Jesus believed Moses wrote it.
Okay.
So that's
fair.
That's the trump card argument, which is that you read Moses, and so the expectation is that Moses wrote the Pentateuch.
There's no reason to get political.
And then from there, I think that which is one of the really interesting things about especially Exodus is there's a lot of Egyptian language and phrasing inside of the actual writing. Mm-hmm. So for instance, he regularly uses like the face or the eye of the land. Well, that's an Egyptian idiom. It's not surprising that Moses would use an Egyptian idiom because Moses was raised and educated inside of that Egyptian system. Mm-hmm. And so there's internal evidence. So like there's kind of two ways to look at it. There's internal evidence, external evidence. I don't really depend very heavily upon external evidence because most of the time it's like somebody said this one thing that makes them think Moses didn't write it. And more often than not, it's just somebody trying to war against the traditional authorship.
Mm-hmm.
But the trump card of it is that Jesus believed that Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
And that passage would be?
You believed Moses, number one. He cites Moses in a number of places where he said, and Moses said.
Okay.
And so, gotcha. Yeah, those are the, and that's how we honestly view, or that's a lot of our understanding of who wrote what in the Old Testament is based upon Jesus' citations of it. And so, and that's not just Jesus' citations of it, but the Pharisees of the day believed that Moses wrote those. Mm-hmm. It's only when super, super, super educated people come in to wage war against the traditional authorship where there's really any debate about it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And even then, most of the time they introduce concepts like JDEP theory, which is the concept is that it was originally written by maybe Moses, like we'll just assume Moses, but then there was probably four or five different authors that came in at a later date to edit. So like even the temple, like there's an argument that the temple language wasn't introduced until the time of Josiah the king. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way that people kind of talk about it. It's source criticism where they go back and revise. Mm-hmm. But in general, the simplest answer is normally the right one, which is that Moses wrote it. It also explains how we know what took place in the Genesis account. Like how do you know Genesis 1, 2, and 3 occurred? Well, that's not hard to understand if you believe that God spoke with Moses like a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his insight into the creation account, the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. That's where that was pinned. It would have probably been oral tradition, but Moses then is the one who would pin it and lay it out.
And I guess there isn't any indication of like when Moses would have written all this would have been like just over a long period of his life or at the end of his life, or is there any indication of that?
Well, Wilderness Wanderings most certainly would have been when Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus would have been written, and probably pretty early. The reason we say early is because the tabernacle ministry really followed them. Like the first thing they do, if you're following Exodus, you're not looking at a whole bunch of time between the actual Exodus account and the conclusion of the book where the tabernacle is erected. Mm-hmm. Then you get into Leviticus where the priests are given their jobs, their responsibilities. And so the tabernacle followed them, or they followed the tabernacle throughout the wilderness wanderings. You're looking at a pretty small period of time there up until the point where the tabernacle is given. And then from there, you would have had Numbers and Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is a speech.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that we can say for certain Moses didn't write, which I assume Joshua probably did, is the recording of the death of Moses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
unless he pre-penned
I'm
that.
I'm going to die now.
He wrote his own obit.
Tell y'all how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So looking through, trying to get these in a little bit of an order. So a lot of these have to do with like the Passover and firstborn accounts.
Okay.
That's last couple of messages.
I call these the big three. At this point in my brain, they're the big three.
The Passover, the firstborn, and the
Feast of Unleavened Bread.
Feast of Unleavened Bread.
They're the big three means of perpetually observing the deliverance from the land of Egypt.
Okay. Yep. It's fair. In regard to the death of the firstborn, a question came up a couple times in our small group. Blake, I'll ask you this question.
Okay.
If the Egyptians had put blood on the doorpost, would God have passed over them? Or did they know? And if they did know, would they have been passed over?
I actually don't think they knew. I think that the information was only given to the Israelites. And so there seems to be that redemptive distinction even throughout, like in my personal reading a couple of weeks ago, I was in Numbers, or is it in Deuteronomy, where I think it's in Deuteronomy, where the Lord basically says, like, I haven't chosen you because you're righteous or because you're great, you know, like it's because. And I'm not even giving you victory because I think that you're good. Like, it's because of the evil of those around you. And I think that that was a moment of judgment for all of Egypt. And as Lawson's pointed out in sermons, it was even a moment, I think, in that judgment that many Egyptians saw the truth of who God was and decided to leave with them. So I don't think that they had the option,
gotcha,
personally.
Yeah, hard to affirm. I'll tell you a position I changed on as I made my way through the Exodus. I'm glad I didn't bring it up at the beginning.
hate it.
Me too. It's like real quick. Let me recant. No, but early on, I was convinced that there was a permanent distinction, so that none of the plagues hit the Israelites. As I progressed through it, I became more and more convinced that some of the early plagues would have affected them. So I think it's almost an impossibility to say that the Nile turning to blood did not affect the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, like you're looking at like the frogs, for instance, the redemptive distinction comes in later inside of the plagues. And so I think that's where the introduction comes, because I do think, as clearly noted in the wilderness wanderings, I mean, immediately after they cross the sea and they enter into the wilderness, you see the sinfulness of Israel instantly put on display.
Mm.
And so I think that what you do have, and Pink made this argument, and I was like, I don't really want to go there as of yet. I was ill-convinced. And then as I made my way and as I continued to preach through and the introduction of the distinctions, it became all the more clear that I think really there was judgment against Israel, I think, for their idolatry. There's an old statement that's been used a long time around the Exodus, which is the Exodus is accomplishing two things. It's getting Israel out of Egypt and Egypt out of Israel. Mm. And so the idea that there's a purging that takes place there because they have imbibed these things,
mm-hmm,
and there's judgment against them. And to say that there's judgment against the people of Israel is literally just to cite history. Mm-hmm. Like it happens over and over, mm-hmm, and over again. And so I think when the redemptive distinction comes in, it comes in pretty loud and clear, where at one point they were probably suffering somewhat together. And that's the reason, that's the primary reason when I look at the account of the Passover, there's no statement of pronouncement. Mm-hmm. Instead, I think it is following through with that redemptive distinction where it's announced to the people of Israel. And as it's announced to the people of Israel, they seemingly, they all do it. Mm-hmm. You know, could there be one rando who decided not to? Perhaps, but I think the primary purpose is to say that the entirety of Israel was marked by blood upon the doorpost. And meanwhile, in Egypt, it was not even announced to them. Mm. And so, you know, then you can ask the question, would he have abided by the blood? I think the would he have abided by the blood, if we want to play this game, I think the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a big leap. It's a big leap to say. And I think most people presume that it was pronounced to the Egyptians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in the Bible that refers to that.
Right. Yeah, that was my answer to the couple people that asked, is that scripture doesn't really say one way or the other. But we do know that there was not a house in Egypt where someone was not dead.
Yeah, 1230.
Which seems to indicate that no one put the blood on the doorpost, even if they did know about it. Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the point that I would disagree with, because I think that there were people in Egypt who would have already, who really were believing.
Right.
And so, like, I think that's illustrated by the plague of hail. You've got many of them going and gathering, seemingly that they would have feared the word of the Lord and they would have gone and done it. And so.
Yeah, that was a question. That was one of the questions that I had is, excuse me, were the plagues distinct? Was that redemptive distinction from the beginning? And so it was the first three plagues, bloods, frogs. What was the third one? Gnats?
Blood, frogs, gnats, flies, or lice technically, most likely with the gnats. But that's where he turns, literally right. Turns the dust into lice or a flying insect of some type, biting insect of some type. And that's where the magicians say, this is the finger of God, we can't do this.
Yeah. And then it's at that point when it says there were no swarms in the land of Israel, mm-hmm. but there were in Egypt.
Right.
So that distinction there. Okay. That's really helpful. So,
It's the start of the second cycle,
right,
where the distinction is made. And that's why I actually took those three plagues together, because the primary point there is there's a distinction here.
Mm-hmm. So in the Passover narrative, it talks about the firstborn many, many, many times. And many times it's mentioned, I guess, assumed that they're male. And so how do we know, were all the firstborn male that died? And if so, how do we know that?
I mean, you think about the culture, firstborn doesn't just mean the first one born, right? I mean, we know this from scripture. I mean, there is another meaning or another understanding of firstborn, because Christ is considered the firstborn, right? But he wasn't technically born. And so I think that it was males, just because firstborn carries with it heir, right? So firstborn is heir. A daughter wouldn't have been an heir, because the wealth of daughters more or less is given away. And so I think firstborn assumes son. But also, I mean, there is a lot of son language throughout, so that it seems understood. Like that, I think that's a secondary argument for it.
Yeah, so I think the loudest argument is in the language itself, but Ephesians, Exodus 4, where God makes this really clear that this is what's going to happen. He says, if you refuse to let my firstborn son go, I will kill your firstborn son.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that helps us understand that he's speaking distinctly of the males. There's also pretty clear language that's masculine around it. The ESV, I really don't know why the ESV did this. There are a couple of times where the King James Version, the Septuagint, they translate it with the word male included. But the ESV, for some reason, doesn't. And I think their argument, as I read, their argument is it doesn't necessitate male. It leans that way. And I'm like, well, if it leans that way, I don't know why we would withdraw it from the text. But And so firstborn male seemingly is the language. So I think what you're looking at there is, yes, it would have been firstborn sons. The best way to understand this is actually in the consecration of the firstborn.
That's where I was going to ask.
Because it requires the consecration of the firstborn male. Mm-hmm. Which, again, the ESV actually removes the word male here.
In chapter 13, though, it doesn't. Like, it specifically refers to it as male.
It says male. So it says male livestock, but the ESV doesn't use male. It's the firstborn. It's your firstborn child, if I'm not mistaken. So it says all of the firstborn. It's just verse 12 of 13. You shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb. All the firstborn of your animals that are male shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey, you shall redeem it. Or if you shall not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons, you shall redeem. And so, like, they use firstborn male, firstborn man upon your, from your sons. Mm-hmm. And so there are arguments that say, no, it's not making reference specifically to the male. It's making reference to men and then sons as children. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a stretch. And the reason I think the nail in the coffin of the argument that it could have been either any firstborn, if it would have been male or female, it is Exodus 4. It's just too explicit. I'm going to come and you don't let my firstborn son go. I'm going to kill your firstborn son. It is targeting not only the son, but I think Blake hit on this already, the heir. It's targeting the translation of wealth through your family, and it's wiping it out. And so the judgment upon Egypt, for instance, is like, where's your wealth going to go? Your firstborn's dead. There's no way for you to press forward, even though obviously like there's still other children. But if you're the firstborn son, your father is expecting that all of your wealth and your legacy would be transferred through you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. So then a question is, why did the animals die? What is it? What was the distinction, you know, the significance of the firstborn of the animals dying?
Like, why couldn't you redeem the animals? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I'm just asking, like, the sinfulness was in man.
We're talking about the actual Passover event, not the actual consecration of the firstborn
correct.
Right now.
Okay, yes, sorry, the Passover event, yeah. Yes. Yes, because the animal, the firstborn of the animals died. And then later in the redemption of the firstborn of the animals had to be redeemed or sacrificed.
Right.
And so it's interesting to me that there's animals involved because the animals didn't sin. So why is that?
I mean, all the people of Israel didn't sin in the way Pharaoh sinned. I mean, I think you see a federal head in Pharaoh in that sense where Pharaoh's sin, all the people of Egypt pay in essence for Pharaoh's sin, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of them feel the weight of his sin. But I mean, I think a secondary part of that is that, like, can you imagine the Egyptians probably knew which of their animals were the firstborn. Like, can you imagine the pronouncement of God's glory that he was like, the rest of them will be fine, but that one's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I think that's all wrapped up in, you know, for I've raised you up for my namesake and I'm going to, you know, your fall will, Pharaoh will proclaim my glory to the nations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he's right. Wealth and judgment are the two that it's attacking upon. I also think the livestock inside of Egypt would not, that they would not be thought of the way that we think about a cow. They would have been thought of rather distinctly. They would have been some venerated, and others.
I mean, yeah, the Israelites had to get it from somewhere. The idea that a cow could be holy, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Like golden calf being like, brought forth,
could be worshipped.
And so, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was. But I mean, I think the primary attack, I think, well put, is the precision of God yet again revealed that the firstborn of cattle. I mean, my goodness. If I had 100 cattle, I don't think there would be a snowball's chance that I could pick out the firstborn cow. Like, I just don't think I'm going to be able to do that. I'm sure that there are farmers who can, but, you know, if you're telling me 100 cows pick the firstborn, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Also, think about the picture of that, though. Like, eventually these, like, animals are used to worship God.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he, I don't know. It's, I don't think that you can like read this for sure into the text, but it's almost like a moment of like, I deserve this kind of worship. Like the Israelites are going to slaughter animals and worship me through sacrifice. And like, I deserve the worship of all of the people behind all these cows too.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. All right. So did God himself strike down the firstborn, or was it a destroying angel?
Yeah. I think the text is actually really explicit that it's the Lord, but you see the phrase, the destroyer. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we should read into that a divorcing of the two, that it's the Lord who destroys the firstborn. I mean, he claims it. He tells it's going to happen. It's clarified and when it occurs, and then there's a recitation of it. Mm-hmm. And so it says the Lord is the one who did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the destroyer, there's good questions about, okay, well, who or what is the destroyer? Again, it's actually an interesting Egyptian language concept. I'm trying to remember, there was actually an Egyptian concept of one that would come and destroy inside of your home. And so the phrase destroyer, I think, could be God's reclamation of, I'm the one to be feared. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's pretty explicit that it's the Lord who goes out. I was asked a question in small group a couple of weeks ago on whether I would place this as a, if we would say that this is a theophany in the sense that this is the second person of the Godhead revealing himself. The interesting thing about this is there's not a single statement that says he's seen.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, and I was thinking about this, I'd be curious what y'all think, but thinking about this, in my mind's eye, it's like an actual passing over of the Lord, like making his way through the neighborhoods, for lack of better terms, of the Egyptian, going door by door.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that I've always thought about it. But I think the better thought is at midnight,
mm-hmm.
like at an hour, at a moment, this all occurs. So there would be an instantaneous death of all of the firstborn in a second. Like if you think about it, like the hour strikes midnight,
mm-hmm.
and all the firstborn of the Egyptians mm-hmm. are dead on the spot.
Yeah, I feel like that first view is from like because of Prince of Egypt.
Probably is.
Because I agree with the second
view
that it was instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, that just shows the power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's literally no telling, you know, the way in which those children and perhaps even grown men that were inside of the home, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they would have died. There's really no telling it, but it seems as though it was a quick and silent death, that it would have been marked by nothing,
mm-hmm.
that it would have just been a silence and a quiet in the home, a simple taking of the breath, and that firstborn instantly losing his life. And I think that's the reason why you have the concept of the wailing, of a discovery of something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Now, in regard to the firstborn, I think often we think of it as like children,
mm-hmm.
but it was all firstborn.
Right.
Like yes. No matter the age.
Yeah. The question, so a good question around this is, so at what point do you stop being the firstborn son and you have started your own family?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. So that's the question, is like, in one of the major debates in most of the commentaries is, what's a firstborn?
Mm-hmm.
And at what point, like if I'm the firstborn and I leave my house and I go and I build a family elsewhere and there's another firstborn son in the house,
mm-hmm.
is it me? Am I the firstborn that's going to be taken, or is it the son, or is it both?
I would say both.
Yeah. Same. I mean, I think it's conjecture, but I think mm-hmm. both is the most logical conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause every firstborn, I think that's just an idea we have from wherever, that's not in the text, of thinking it's like, mm-hmm. it's only just children, but I would think of no matter how old they are, from the 90-year-old to the 1 day old, if they're the firstborn.
Mm. Yeah.
You can't admit, like one of the phrases that you hear about World War One is that like, Britain lost a generation of men, you know, mm-hmm. and you think about Egypt lost not a generation, but I mean,
all of
when
it.
You go, we haven't gotten there yet, right? Yeah. But spoiler, a lot of them die in the water.
True.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler.
Like you're losing more than just a generation of men. You're losing at least, I mean, partially every generation.
Think about how easily another nation could have walked in the door and conquered them.
Right.
Like literally just walk in the door at this point because they've already been defeated. But what's weird about it is seemingly that they actually build back. Because I mean, you still have commandments of do not go back to Egypt. But it's incredible. You think about the devastation that took place over, we don't know how long the plagues were. It's kind of a debate between nine months to 2 years. But the devastation that they were that happened there, I didn't even take into consideration at this point the fact that we don't know how many, but a great multitude of their army dies instantaneously inside of the sea.
Yeah, but people had already died. I mean, you talk about lack of water, you talk about hail, you talk about all of these things. Women, men, women, and children have already died.
Yeah.
And then you have all the firstborn and then the seemingly all all the army.
And a great deal of their weapons of warfare. I mean, chariots in and of themselves were one of the greatest weapons of warfare that existed.
And they're at the bottom.
So the significance of the firstborn versus like the secondborn, and I know we've talked about this a little bit, but this was something we kind of discussed in our small group as well, is what is, like, why is it the firstborn that's important that God required the death of the firstborn? Like, why would you say there's significance in that versus the second or third born?
Are you talking about in the consecration of the firstborn or the actual Passover event?
Well, I guess in both, because the consecration comes from the actual Passover.
Well, the consecration of the firstborn comes from the fact that God requires their life based upon the fact that a payment was made for them. So it actually is anchored in the actual Passover event, because there's a substitute made. There's even though their life was demanded, and therefore their lives are owed to God, consecration being that major theme. So if you're looking at it from why then is the very firstborn required? And the reason is because Israel is God's firstborn. And I would recommend a sermon from a couple of months ago at this point, where I think the title of it is actually just Israel is My Firstborn Son. And there's so much debate over the terminology of Israel as my firstborn, because I think everybody, as they hear that, their first thought is, well, but what about Jesus? To which we say, absolutely, Jesus is the firstborn from among many brothers. Jesus is the firstborn from among the dead. He's the firstborn of all creation. Like, the list goes on. But so if you're looking at this from the concept of firstborn, as in there can only be one because it's the first of something, as opposed to that which is superior or preeminent. And so if you're looking at it from the superior preeminent aspect, he's likened the entire way through this Israel to his firstborn son. And the consequence is, if you are going to oppress and wage war against my firstborn son, I'm going to kill yours. And so, but the concept of that destroyer coming through and sparing just the firstborn son, like, that's what's being preserved. I would actually argue that the firstborn son is a mercy.
Because that it wasn't all of them?
Yes. Yes. The reason it was firstborn is because he was displaying his power and dominion and simultaneously judging all the gods of Egypt, which the firstborn of Pharaoh's son would have been an embodiment of the god of the moon. Interestingly enough, at the height of his power, a full moon. And so he's demonstrating his power and his authority yet again. But the major theme there is he's doing exactly what he promised he would do, that the firstborn would perish. But then he takes that from the concept of the firstborn, he's executing that judgment, and then he takes that and really redeems it as a picture. And the picture is that there's going to be a firstborn who comes, and he's going to pave the way for the second, third, fourth, and fifth. And so that translates. This is why it's important to recognize that when you're reading stories like this, God's not doing one thing. He's doing a bunch of things. So he's declaring judgment, and at the very same time, he's pronouncing judgment in the fact that the lamb has to be slain, but provision as well. And the provision, it's even made note that the firstborn is really the means by which this provision is going to come, Christ being the firstborn. Something that we didn't bring out in the sermon from last week is the fact that Jesus actually pays this price as well, like this redemption price. It's in Luke 2. He brings a sacrifice to the temple. There is no moment. I think this is so interesting. What's the name of the priest who sees him? Zechariah? Yeah. So the priest who sees him, actually this whole exchange takes place. But Zechariah gets him, and there isn't a conversation of the exchange that takes place. Instead, Zechariah is like, oh, I can die now, because the firstborn, the true firstborn that we've been waiting for, has come. And think about how many times he's done this, the redemption of the firstborn, and he sees the Messiah, heart filled with joy, hands him back. and goes and dies happy.
Mm-hmm.
Did I answer your question?
I think so. Okay. Do you have any comments on that, Blake?
No.
Okay. All right. So I was thinking about one thing we were discussing is this is kind of this concept of like which direction. This is kind of, I guess, a speculative comment that kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. So bear with me.
Yeah.
Which direction in the eternal decree does like types and shadows flow?
Ooh.
So you have the firstborn concept here, and throughout history, it builds into Christ as the fulfillment of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in God's eternal decree is Christ set forth, and then God decrees all of these types and shadows, so that the reason that there is a firstborn is, and the firstborn is passed over, and there must be a firstborn redemption, and all of these things is because that's what Christ is. So Christ is the preeminent fulfillment, and he creates all the shadows. So, like, which direction does that go?
Eternally.
Yeah, it all happened at once.
Yeah. It's really, I think it's different. It's difficult to order that. But what I can't, here, I'll cheat by reading the Bible to you.
The secret things belong to the Lord.
Yeah, that would be funny. Romans 16, though, says, "Now to him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but has now been disclosed and through the prophetic writings have been made known to all nations according to the command of the eternal God." And so you see in that really a statement of it's hidden, but it was mm-hmm. hidden there before he came. But mm-hmm. now that he has come, and now that I would argue on the other side of Pentecost, that's in, that light has been given. Now mm-hmm. it's been revealed so that it can be understood. And so the question of when, what comes first? Mm-hmm. Well, it's very clear that gospel is decreed from the foundation of the world. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very safe argument to say, especially considering the Abrahamic covenant being prototypical mm-hmm. of the new covenant, not the new covenant, prototypical of the new covenant, really mm-hmm. important language. And so in the midst of that, you have this thing that's set forth, the promise being made. That promise really doesn't start there. It mm-hmm. actually goes back. It's just been made known. Mm-hmm. And so as that promise has been made known, then you see it beginning to unfold. And so I would argue that what you have both in the eternity past and inside the new, right? You have a spotlight on the Lord Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And it's concealed up until the point where God so chooses to reveal it, namely at Pentecost. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that there's a spotlight essentially shining from the old on the Lord Jesus Christ. The shadows fall in the Old Testament, making known who he will be teaching, mm-hmm. right? So we say the Old Testament is written for our instruction. That's why mm-hmm. these things are given. Mm-hmm. They're meant to set forth Christ to us. And so if they're meant to set forth Christ to us, we have to know for certain that Christ was already in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's building to that. And then when the incarnation happens, it's like, oh, here he mm-hmm. is. And when the new covenant is brought full force into fruition, it's like all of this has been moving in this direction forever. So when I look back now, I look back with the full light of the new in a way that is illuminating.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I see, oh, he's always been teaching us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think about, and you just mentioned this passage, but these things happen to them for our example.
1 Peter 1, yeah.
1 Peter 1.
Yeah.
So these things happen to them for our example. Like that's the reason that it happened. And so I was thinking about God's eternal plan is the end is our glorification, the eternal state, like everything that happens prior to that is like God's decree of history to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like the, what's the view where God learns stuff that starts with a T?
Open theism.
Yeah, open theism. So it's not open theism where it's like God is learning things and is like, oh, I'm going to use this firstborn motif and bring Jesus and let him do that, you know, mm-hmm. and then it's all going to build. But it's more like God starts with the very end and then decrees all of history and providentially orders all of history in order to meet that final goal.
Mm.
And so That's what I was thinking about with the firstborn deal.
I would also argue, though, like, it providentially orders all of history to put the cross at the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. Like, I think that thinking about the consummation of things, we can lose sight of the fact that the cross is at the center of all of this, right? Even though it's not the end, it is the mechanism for getting to the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I think so. On that First Peter text, verse 12, chapter 1, sorry, First Peter 1:12, it was revealed to them that they were serving not themselves but you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's speaking of the prophets, that they're writing mm-hmm. with an expectation of, I'm preparing as I write this. I'm writing for the generation that will lay hold of Christ. Mm-hmm. Like I'm preparing this to look forward to him. But I mean, you can imagine, like, Moses is penning the Day of Atonement.
Mm.
And as he's penning the Day of Atonement, he's writing this. It's revealed to him that he's not just serving himself in that writing, but he's serving the generation that will see the Passover lamb really offered.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we say that Old Testament saints are justified the same way that we are. They're not justified by hope in the Day of Atonement. They're justified by looking forward to the promised lamb who will come. So he's writing this knowing that we'll be partakers of the same thing together by faith. Mm. And that's, I think, crucial for our understanding of how we read and study the Old Testament. I think it's also important, not only how we read the Old Testament, but how we think of those men.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think of them as disconnected from the same life-giving source. We think about them looking forward to the same life-giving source. They're not partaking of the substance of Christ through the administration of the old covenant. They're partaking in the new covenant because they've looked forward by faith to the promised lamb.
Mm.
And in an apologetic sense, I feel like I've heard a lot, you know, like, why did God, quote unquote, waste so much time or so much space of the Bible on the Old Testament if the New Testament's what really matters, you know? And it's like, no, if you see the Old Testament for what it actually is, then you see that this is one book about Jesus, and you have all of these types and shadows that are shouting to you about Jesus, then it doesn't feel like, you know, it doesn't feel strange to say, yeah, 3/4 of our Bible is Old Testament, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does it ever just hit you, the privilege that we have of living in the age that we do?
1000%, all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
But you know what's crazy? It's if we were on the other side, and this is purely based on the fact that we believe and uphold the doctrine of election, on the other side of it, we would have still looked forward by faith. We would have just looked forward dimly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the beauty of it, because when you're thinking about this, participants in the new covenant, like, the way that we consider it is we're participants because God has elected and adopted us into his family. He hasn't changed his methodology.
Mm-hmm.
He's always done that. And so to think that there are Old Testament saints who lived under the administration of the Mosaic, but were by faith participants in the new, that's miraculous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What?
That's why so many people don't believe in it.
Yeah.
Sounds too good to be true.
So in that light, I guess we were talking about on this past Sunday how the greater concept of God redeeming versus God executing his wrath.
Mm.
So in that sense of, like, it's just for God to execute his wrath. But the real question is, like, how is it that God can redeem, which is, of course, answered in the cross.
Mm.
But how that is what really should cause us to really wonder and say, how can this be? Because most people, their hang up is like, how can God execute his wrath and kill all the firstborn in Egypt? How can God, you know, does God have the right, you know, said a few weeks ago, to do this.
Mm.
And the question is, like, that's not a really good question. Is, does God have the right to do this? It's does God have the right to sin, to redeem sinners?
Mm.
And if nothing is dead, then seemingly if he's going to abide by his rules, then he doesn't have the right to save sinners apart from something dying. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, apart from something dying, I think that's that was always, like, the good Paul Washer moment in all of his sermons that I listened to in high school, where, like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, how can this be? You know? Yeah. And, because it, he doesn't. And my favorite line about that is that Greg Gilbert uses the phrase that a lot of people believe that God is an unscrupulous janitor who just kind of, like, throws dirt around instead of actually cleaning it up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that to think about, a lot of people think about God that way, right? Like, he's just kind of turning a blind eye to sin. But the beauty of Exodus is that it's shouting to us that that all sin has to be paid for. Mm-hmm. That in some way, sin has to be paid for, and it will be paid for, mm-hmm. whether through the death of the guilty or the death of something innocent on behalf of the guilty. Which is continued. I mean, one of my favorite phrases in Leviticus is when it talks about the lambs, it says a male without blemish, and about the fact that Christ is the male without blemish, mm-hmm. right? And so he continues that motif throughout.
Yeah, I think the great litmus test for this question is when you read Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated, what's surprising to you?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like if you read Jacob I loved and Esau I hated, and you're surprised that God hates Esau, you really do not know who he is, who God is. And so there's this disposition where we demand of God that he be loving and gracious by our own definitions, as opposed to God's justice must be done, right? Mm-hmm. This is why Romans 3 is the crescendo of Romans 3 is the phrase that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Christ, because those aren't real categories. Mm-hmm. Like they're you cannot maintain being just and to justify a sinner, right? Like when we talk of, like, even the way that we use justify something, if I'm having a conversation with someone and they're trying to convince me that they weren't sinning, we say, you're just trying to justify yourself. Mm-hmm. You're trying to indicate that you are not in trespass, which is an indication that you yourself are not just. But when we look at Romans 3, the premise of it is that just and the justifier can only be had through a substitution that is perfect, and that in a transact in a sense of transaction does actually bear my guilt. And we're not given the insight into, like, what's the mechanism of my guilt and sin being laid upon Christ's shoulders. I don't really need that mechanism. I'm perfectly content to say, I don't really know how that played out. I just know it happened. And so there's a system inside of the priesthood, the priestly ministry, of transference, where the priest would place his hand on the lamb and confess there's the sins of the people of Israel over them. And the idea is that the sins were actually transferred onto them. Now we know that the blood of goats and bulls can't take away sin. So what's the purpose of that picture of transference? It's that God really does, in a true sense, transfer my sin upon the shoulders of Christ, so that he is just in his condemnation to me. When we read Galatians 2:20 and we say, I have been crucified with Christ, we read that and we're like, oh yeah, Jesus died for me. It's like, no, you misunderstand. All of your sin was laid upon his shoulders. You were crucified with Christ. The just penalty for your sin was executed there. And so we're right to say, I was crucified with Christ. There I died. And on the other side of it, then we say with great confidence, therefore, the life I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. So that transference is substantive in that just and the justifier is the only means by which, or substitution is the only means by which God can be just and the justifier while upholding his own essence and being. Any other form of salvation, at least by the man's ideas, would violate one or the other.
So why did God choose to set his love
on Israel? Look at
Israel
you.
Instead of Egypt.
Oh, because he wanted to.
Yep. I think, you know, he ends up, that passage I referenced earlier when he says, well, it's not because you're great or mighty. You know, I think that you can read in that it's actually the opposite, right? There's something pretty glorious about you know, one guy and his wife who are super old and don't have any kids.
God chooses the weak things to share.
Yeah, that's where I was going. There is no way to look past safely. I'll say this. There's no safe way to look past why did God choose Israel and not Egypt? There's no way to look past that without being in danger. The best thing to do is to simply say that's because he wanted to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
God, you know, a phrase that's used is God is pure action. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as though he's influenced by Israel. It's not as though he's influenced by Egypt. He's mm-hmm. impassible. Nothing is altering his mm-hmm. will. He's doing what he wills. Mm-hmm. And so his election of Israel in that sense to be the firstborn son through which the promises of God would come to fruition, through which he would reveal himself. I think early on I said that that Israel is becoming the stage by which he will proclaim the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly mm-hmm. what happens. So he elects, I can give you the purpose as like, mm-hmm. so this is mm-hmm. why he chose, this is why Israel was chosen. This was the purpose, right? To mm-hmm. set forth Christ, to bring all the promises of God to fruition. Romans 9 tells us this, mm-hmm. that to them belong the adoption and the promises and the patriarchs, and the list goes on. And so that's the purpose, but why them over mm-hmm. the next?
Mm-hmm.
Will and will alone.
Because mm-hmm. is it in Ezekiel? I may be getting the book wrong, but when I think it's maybe the passage you were mentioning, Blake, is it is, I did not choose you because you were more mighty than any other people, or because you were more righteous than any mm-hmm. other people. But he says, I loved you because I loved you.
Yep.
Like that's it. Like that's because Israel like wasn't more righteous than Egypt.
No.
And Egypt wasn't more wicked than Israel.
Yeah.
And you can, because you end up seeing Israel do all the things that Egypt did and eventually do all the things that the Canaanites did that they drove out of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And yet God still, set his love on them.
Yep. Yep.
And we see that. I think it's interesting that a lot of people that maybe have an issue with God's freedom in election, they don't have a problem with God's election of Israel as a nation.
Right.
But it's the exact same thing, and the reasons that God chose Israel are the reasons that he chooses us as well.
Yeah.
It's not because we're any better than anybody else, but he chose to love us.
Yeah, it's the reason Romans 9 references this. One of the mm-hmm. reasons that people debate Romans 9, like, oh, this is a national election. It's using a national election as an illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, we have to apply it appropriately and bring it into the new. But yeah, it's very clear that the reason that God chose Jacob and not Esau, and those do become national entities.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
you have Edom and you have Israel that come from those two nations and so those two men. So his statements there is, I have chosen Israel to be this grand stage from which all of this will take place over mm-hmm. and against. And it isn't over and against mm-hmm. Edom and Egypt and all of these other wicked nations.
Mm.
And so,
you think about the prevalence of human pride, like we need that. We need to be reminded of that. Because we are so quick to say, to look at ourselves and say, we are so much better than those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, I was just looking at Deuteronomy 9 when he says that, he ends up saying it again, like it's not because of your righteousness. He says, for you are a stubborn people. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, that, you know, yet for the grace of God, there go I. Like
mm-hmm.
the prevalence of human pride, even, and this is what's astounding about us who believe that God had the most to do with our salvation, that mm-hmm. we can look at the lost around us and say, like, I mean, look at those people. Like, they're so unrighteous. It's like, mm-hmm. as if we would be anything else apart from the grace bestowed to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's good. All right, I think the last kind of subject that we can touch on is the lamb and the donkey.
Donkey.
So, Lawson.
Smart donkey. Goodness.
Did you, didn't you preach this sermon?
I did.
Was it in?
Romans, Romans 3.
Okay, Romans, because I thought it was on a Sunday
morning. Couldn't find my sermon notes. Looked for my sermon notes all week, couldn't find them.
Are you serious?
Just listened to it.
because I didn't want to listen to myself. Because I was like, because I remember.
Sermon of the, yep, Lamb and the Donkey.
Connor was working with me.
Yeah, he wanted to write a book.
Yeah, we were going to write a book, The Lamb and the Donkey. We were going to write like a song book. Called The Firstborn. Yeah, it was like this whole big thing. And I was thinking it was Old Testament survey in Numbers or something. That makes
Romans
sense.
Romans 3.
Okay, yep. Romans 3, because I was like, man, I know that we've talked
about it. It was actually really fun thinking about this from a different anchor point, because what I was doing is I was, so it was when we were defining the big Christian words in Romans 3, and mine was redemption. And so it's like, why is redemption such a loaded word?
Sure.
And so the purpose, and when we were doing that, was to fill those words up.
Right.
And that's the reason that I used the lamb and the donkey. And I borderline re-preached that with a new lens, thinking about it inside of the narrative of the Exodus, and specifically the Passover event.
So you ed-littened yourself.
which I have the right to do.
That's still plagiarism.
No, it's not. It belongs. No.
It is.
Okay, well, I'll, yeah.
English teacher said
I can assure you that I didn't use my sermon notes from the last one because I couldn't find them.
I looked everywhere. He plagiarized his thoughts.
Yeah. You can plagiarize yourself, bro.
Can you plagiarize your thoughts?
Real. Yeah, I know that it's real, written. But it's not. Like, it's just silly. the lamb and the donkey,
don't serve the children stale bread.
What is that?
I just made that up.
Oh, I mean,
idea.
Oh, yeah. I got you.
You cooked it 3 years ago.
Long time ago, yeah.
But you know what? I asked our small group, does anybody remember when Lawson preached his sermon?
Nobody remembers
that. Everybody's like, nope. Yep.
So, I actually thought about that.
I mean, I don't remember it.
Yeah, I was like, nobody's going to, but that sermon had a big impact on me.
Yeah.
And so there are a couple of sermons that are just like, they just hit me. Mm-hmm. And that one stood out to me. So when I got there, the thing that I made myself do as I walked into that text was check myself at the door, which is, sometimes I've got a presupposition and I want to preach that presupposition. It's like, no, I need to delete that and then rework through it and make sure that I'm preaching it from Exodus and not trying to give a biblical theology of redemption. Mm.
So when, in that passage specifically, it's talking about, I think you were making the point of it basically representing clean and unclean animals.
Yeah.
But that wasn't in the passage. Like, it doesn't say clean and unclean animals. It says all animals, and then it says a donkey.
Yeah, but Numbers 8 or 18 clarifies that the clean animals have a specific purpose. And so, it's Leviticus 28 that it's mentioned in, and Numbers 18 that it's mentioned. I think it's Numbers is where he clarifies it, which is exactly what has to take place. The clean animal must be sacrificed. It literally, the statement is it cannot be redeemed, cannot. Mm-hmm. So it's not even an option. The blood would be sprinkled on the altar. The fat would be offered as a food offering. And then the food would be, the flesh is what it says. It would be given to the priest for their food.
Mm-hmm. Now, but the unclean animals in regard to consecration, like that was given to them for their service because, is that correct? Because when we read in Numbers, like there's a group, there's... like when basically the tithe is given from the rest of Israel to Levite, because the Levite has no inheritance.
Right.
And so they're given all of these things. And that's why they get to eat the meat of the sacrifices. Cause that's their food.
That's their actual food. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so when it comes to that the lamb and the donkey specifically, like, I find that really interesting, that whole, redemption, substitution. And the thought was, is there a correlation there between Christ riding in to on the Jerusalem donkey?
This
on
is funny.
Donkey.
Julie, Don sent a message that Julie Terrell wrote this in her Bible. So there's a ton of references to donkeys in both the Old and the New Testament. I don't know if I would link the two, except for the fact that there is a picture of, and this is the reason I make this reference, is because you're looking at the kingship of Christ being ushered in when he's coming into Jerusalem, right? He's riding on the donkey, and the proclamation is essentially, "Behold, our King."
That's a fulfillment of prophecy.
No? It is a fulfillment of prophecy in Zechariah,
riding on a colt, on the foal of a donkey.
Yes, and then you've got the donkey statement in. The blessing of Judah.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, I think you've got a number of references there. I don't know if I would link those two. So, like, Pink spent, like, three or four pages going through all the ways that we're like a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
He was using, can I say this? He was using the King James version.
Right.
And so it was comedic to read. And his last line was, "Can you say that you yourself are?" And he goes on to all these adjectives. Anyway, but yeah, so I think we have to be careful to go and to grab those. Like, that's the major point, is to say, you're like the donkey. You're the wicked, immovable. List goes on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the major purpose there is to link it to the uncleanness to sin, and that being the primary thrust moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I could just be blind to it at this point, where there's a connection that I'm missing. I looked at it pretty hard, because I'll be honest with you, that'll preach.
Right.
And so I was like, if I'm gonna find it.
Yeah, you want it to, right?
Yeah, want it to. Yeah.
In essence, the sins of the world, you know, riding on the donkey.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If I had a dollar for every time I thought something, I was like, that'll preach. And then I looked at it and I was like, nah, it won't, because it's not real.
So my that'll preach was, you know, there's then the synoptic gospels, I can't even remember which one's which, but one says there is the donkey, and one is a donkey and her colt.
Yeah.
And so then if you read into that the colt was the firstborn that had to be redeemed.
Whoa, bro.
Then you can have the lamb, the true lamb, riding on the donkey that is going to pay for
redeeming. You can make the argument. This is where I say, you can make the argument where they're making their way into the redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really do think the picture of that redemption of the firstborn, when you take the donkey and the lamb, despite the fact that I apparently botched the delivery of it, you're carrying them both,
mm-hmm.
because you have to say, this is what I'm redeeming. This is the price for the redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that would, I could catch that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
but yeah, so look, we kind of tell you something. This is one of my, I had in my mind, like the illustration there,
mm-hmm.
and I had been looking forward to that illustration, because I thought that it preached to me, if I can say it that way. It's like there's a picture of, and I mean, it landed at the last section of it, but when you're thinking about it from the perspective of, you're making a decision between a donkey and a lamb that has so much redemptive principles and properties attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the easiest decision ever. I'm just breaking the neck of the donkey and I'm keeping the lamb.
Hmm.
I think, though, and we talked about this in my small group, when you think about the donkey, like, I think you did a really good job of saying that the lamb is redemptive, right?
Yeah.
But there also is the reality that killing the donkey is very costly.
It is costly.
Like, if you're talking about, like, a lamb's not pulling a wagon.
So even like the concept of a beast of burden,
yeah,
and maintaining that, it is important, because in an agricultural society, you have to have it.
Right. So, like, I think that was something that really came out in our small group, was like, you think about the weight and the feeling of loss of being like, we kind of needed that donkey.
Yeah.
you know, and it's gone. And just a reminder, I think that's a reminder to the people that God's going to take care of us. Mm. And with one individual who likes to ask me questions about the sermons, I likened it to the tithe, right? Like, often give money to the church, it's like, in that is a proclamation, obviously, that everything's the Lord, but also is a proclamation that, like, the Lord is going to take care of us.
Yep.
And this small amount that we are giving, like, if you want to think about missing it, you'll think about missing it. But if you want to think about the fact that He has always and will always take care of you.
Yep.
So could a firstborn lamb be sacrificed for a firstborn donkey?
Nope. And that's what it has to pay. So
does that theoretically mean that a donkey
would pay its own price?
Okay.
It would be able to pay its own price.
So a firstborn lamb has to be sacrificed for itself.
Yeah.
So a donkey had to be some other than a firstborn lamb to be sacrificed for it.
Yeah.
What I find is really interesting is that the firstborn lamb and of the clean animals had no opportunity for redemption.
Mm-mm. It was dying.
But the unclean animals have an opportunity.
Isn't that crazy?
That doesn't make sense, Charles.
I said that.
That'll preach. There you go.
It does.
Angels versus men.
Oh, I didn't think about that. I was thinking of the distinction between, like, if we're also, if
you just made that up. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think the clean animal needs no redemption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it needs no redemption. The unclean animal is the one that needs redemption. The question is, why would you even make a provision for it? Just kill it. And I mean, because really, even though it would be costly, you're right. Sure. Just kill it. And then you go to the second born.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And then you should have, you should still have what you need. But the concept of providing a redeeming price for the firstborn, you just got to ask yourself the question, why? And then why is that the language that rides the whole way into the New Testament? Like, this is the, if you think about, like, we grab a statement inside of the Old Testament when we're reading it. So for instance, like I made a statement to somebody a while back that Adam was a priest in the garden. Well, when you're looking at that, you're like, oh, well, I mean, how can you really say that? And I'm like, well, if you're taking it in isolation, it'd be really difficult. But I can make that statement based upon the rest of the Old Testament. The rest of the Old Testament has a prototypical priest in the garden. He's the king of the garden. Like, you look at that language and it's pretty clear. But the prototypical aspects are going to be smaller and they're going to be developed. Mm-hmm. And so when you're thinking about it from the perspective of a development, the statement of the firstborn paying the price, and then you make your way into the New Testament, and then Galatians 4, when it tells you that God sent his firstborn son to redeem his adoptive sons, and you're like, oh, he's the firstborn that redeemed all the adopted brothers. Mm-hmm. And so like that picture is, he paved the way, the door's open. Now you just come in and you're a part of the family.
So the firstborn lamb can redeem the donkeys.
Boom.
You did it. You did it. I mean, figuratively, you were absolutely correct.
But yeah. I do think that's what's so beautiful about the Gospels when you read them is like, for all of these years, like, the Israelites are looking for these different things, right? Like, you're looking for that lamb. You're looking for the prophet who Moses said would be like him. You're looking for the king like David. You're looking for, like, all of these things. And it's like, Jesus comes on the scene and he is all of those, right? Like, all of those hopes are found in him. And there's something so powerful about, like, you see him and you can never exhaust all of these different ways, thinking about all of these different ways that he is the fulfillment of every Old Testament hope, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, the big three. So on that, like the big three that I mentioned, like the Passover meal, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the consecration of the firstborn are all anchored into this one thing. And what's really important about this is what he wants sticking out in their minds for the entirety of national Israel's existence. Mm-hmm. And so the big question you have to ask is, why these? And so, like, when you think about it from that perspective, what Blake just said, it's like he wanted these to be in the minds of his people, not disconnected from one another, but interconnected with the idea that, well, why is it that we live in a celebratory, restful state? Because the lamb was slain. Why is it that our secondborn, thirdborn, fourthborn doesn't have to pay the price? And so all of these questions really do, I think, erupt in the mind of the one who's observing them. And then you make your way into the New Testament. And as you enter into the New Testament, there's this loud proclamation, because all of it was pointing to you, this one man who would bring about the better Exodus, who would provide, who would be the better lamb, and who would provide a lasting rest. Not looking forward year to year to this moment of unleavened bread, but one where you live in perpetual celebration and rest.
Hmm. That's good. So I think we've learned. Have we learned that God's love is blind?
We talked about it. Not really blind. It's like,
yeah, I wouldn't say that God's love is blind, because that scares me. That's like up there with reckless love.
Right.
But, yes. Yeah, but it is like not dependent on attraction.
Right. It's not on our righteousness.
Yeah. Yeah,
our absolutely. Attractiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not based upon him who wills or him who runs, but yeah, upon him who
good.
Has mercy.
You should write that down.
I should write that down.
Yep.
I wonder where I got that from.
Yep. That is very good. All right. Well, in conclusion, Blake has a Bible verse.
Yeah, he does.
His Bible's open. Close your eyes and point.
I've already
Blake.
Read the verse that
That's
was
right.
for. this is good.
Oh, you got it. You're the doxology king. Is it doxology? What's it called?
It's called a benediction.
Benediction.
Brother.
Sorry.
this is all I can think of. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross.
So I'd like to thank two of my favorite pastors, Lawson Harlow and Blake McCullough, for their time spent today. Fellas, I don't know what to say now.
It's been a good time talking with you two donkeys.
My brothers and my friends, Godspeed.
The beans get stuck in your teeth.
He is eating, just for clarity, I'm not eating. Blake is eating, and he is eating coffee lovers espresso beans.
Oh, those are good.
Chocolate covered. Is it just chocolate covered?
From Trader Joe's?
Chocolate covered espresso beans, yeah. Shout out to
Sharoni.
Sharon Day.
Also known as the Walking Happy.
They taste good, but it's like the residue. You know, what's left is like grounds. It's like...
Yeah.
Like if you get grounds at the bottom of your coffee.
You're literally eating coffee beans.
Hey, I had, for the very first time in my life, I had espresso-covered pork tenderloin at Blake's house, which was really, really good. I was surprised by, you told me this, and I was like, that sounds terrible.
Coffee rub, baby.
Coffee rub. It was really good.
Homemade coffee rub at that. Homemade.
Is that like used grounds, or do you,
no, it's fresh new grounds? It's new coffee. You just grind it up real small.
Mm-hmm.
And I use like dark coffee
mm-hmm.
because
you're not going to brew with that, obviously.
Yeah. And respectfully, like if you give me coffee and it's really dark, I might just use it as a
which is a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah. It's still being loved by
yeah,
people.
It was.
Yeah. And you do a little, you know, it's very chili forward. Like it tastes like a lot of chili flavors. Like
yeah, that's fair.
Cumin, chili mm-hmm. powder, red pepper, a little cinnamon. A little brown sugar.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yep. All right.